Yeah. Everybody ready? We're going to get a presentation going in just a few seconds. So this is the home stretch, three final presentations. And then there'll be more event that we'll talk about later. But three presentations, starting with presentation team, Charlene Kreis, who you met earlier, the vice chair of the Squaxin Island Tribe Tribal Council, will be joined by Melissa Poe, who works at Washington Sea Grant, and Alita Post, who also works at the Squaxin Island Tribe. She's the garden manager for the community garden there. So I think we'll hear from Charlene, then Melissa, then Alita. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's good to be back, and thank you for attending the Strengthen the Community Resilience. If you look up here at this this art, it's a representation of ancient teachings. The teachings are called Gwazadit. In our teachings, for us to pay attention to what is going on in the seasons, the spring, summer, fall, winter, but also infant, child, adult, elder. Physical, mental, spiritual, emotional. These are all part of some of the teachings that go into the Gwazadit. And what that word means is teachings of the ancestors. For our tribal people, the teachings of the ancestors were very vital to who we are as Native people living close to the natural resources. Earlier in the day, I mentioned how that our tribal people had longevity of life. Some of our people, longevity of life was 120, 130. This is through our spoken history. And as a young person, I found difficulty to, how could someone live to be so old? They did. I was over at Coeur d'Alene, at the Coeur d'Alene tribe, and they had this wonderful little museum, and they had this plaque. And on this plaque, they talk about an elder who lived to be 150 years old. And I'm like, oh! And then my husband, his ancestry is from Macaw, from the Wyatch village, and he also is Elwha. And one of his relatives from the Macaw Nation had posted that one of their relatives had lived to be 130 years old, and then one of their other relatives next to him, 120. Now, it's very difficult for us as modern people to really understand how could people live so long. I'm one of those people. And when I asked the elders said it was the food, it was the water, it was the social structure. When we think about food, it's hard for us, even as modern people, to really think about the depth of what food were eaten. For our tribal people, when there was a deer, elk that would be taken, there was a ceremony. Thank you. This ceremony wasn't just for show and for like, oh, that makes me feel good. No, the ceremony was a very important part of a teaching tool for us to remember that we, excuse me, had just taken a life. That life was alive, jumping through the bushes, and that we had to be very conscious of what we were doing. And then the processing of the food was very important. There was a procedure, of course, for skinning the elk or the deer, and the process of how that food would be taken or used, right down to the bones. The bones were an important part of what we would use. We would take the greatest care, along with our salmon. Our salmon was another ceremony that our people would have so that we would remember to always be a heart of gratitude, that we would always be thankful that we have these gifts of food that were given to us. Berries. I remember as a little girl, my grandmother had made me a berry basket, and it had a rag that I would tie around my waist. And I felt like a big girl, and it must have been four, and that I had my own basket, and I could pick my berries. And my grandmother, taught me a little song to pick as I'm picking my berries and putting them into my basket. And it felt so good to be able to take my little amount of berries and put it into her basket. What did that do? That instilled into my heart and into my mind that contribution that I am helping with these berries. I'm helping my grandmother. We're happy. But she made me happy by allowing me to help and assist. And the berries, to this day, I love berries. So when we look at this art piece, this is Taylor Kreiss. He put this together, and you can see there are four sections. Okay, thank you. Four sections to the art piece, and it's to show the different seasons of our of what we care about as far as our animals and the foods that we eat. I wanted to share with you too that the foods that we have here on this land, they have a relationship with the seasons. They also have a relationship with the different soils, the waters that are there, the different levels of land that they're on, the alkalinity of the soil. These were all very important. To our tribal people, our people would pay attention to certain plants that would grow in certain areas, and these areas were very important for gathering of different medicines or foods. The roots are very important for our tribal people too. When I was a young mother and I was pregnant with my first child, I kept thinking I wanted to eat chalk, something about chalk, but I never did. I never did go get a chunk of chalk and chew on it. But I just couldn't understand why I had this hunger for chalk. And then one day there was this wonderful elder, Edith McLeod, and I'm in this area and I go to Edith's table, and she has all these foods in front of her, and she's got her bandana on, and she looks right at me, and I'm looking at her, and I walk up to her, and we have this wonderful conversation. And as we're talking, she goes, "You try this, try this." So she gives me this dried bulb. I bit into it, and I go, "Oh, that was it. That was it. That's what I wanted." And so what she said that our tribal people have a memory, and that memory is ancestral memory. And sometimes our bodies need these foods. And at that time, being pregnant with my first child, I really think I needed that camas, that dried camas, which is like our carbohydrates, potatoes. And I really needed that. And so genetics these days, you know, they talk about how that genetics were available. We all got these genetics that are within us. Our tribal elders say, in all of us reside the ancestors. And so Edith McLeod, she was telling me the memories that we have as Indigenous people, sometimes it is so real to us that our body is craving and needs these type of foods. And so that's my story about the camas. Oh, my time is out. I enjoy being here, and I could talk for hours, and we have some other presenters for you. I'd like to introduce you to a wonderful lady, Melissa Poe. She's done a lot of work within our tribe, and I'd like to introduce Melissa.
Thank you, Charlene, a very important advisor and mentor. Over the past few years, we've been working together on community participatory action research, and the Squaxin Island Tribe and I have been talking with members through interviews and workshops about the importance of the Salish Sea, the water, and Puget Sound for first foods and community well-being. Some of the goals of this work have been to identify the ways in which first foods contribute to individual and community well-being, and to define from a local and Squaxin Island tribal Indigenous perspective what might be indicators that could be used to evaluate changes in the status of health and well-being. These can be used to then evaluate the potential impacts from ocean changes, many of the types of changes that we've been hearing all day, including ocean acidification was a key focus of our work and other ocean-based changes and the impacts to shellfish and seafoods. But also in community workshops to dialogue about the kinds of potential actions and responses that are available and ongoing in the community and what the priorities might be. So first, in our first phase, through interviews with elders, knowledge holders, shellfish harvesters, fishermen, and other community members, we set out to better understand the importance of ocean-based first foods on well-being. And I'm going to show here a sampling of some of the key attributes of the ways in which the first foods from the ocean and also from the land are important to Squaxin and Island community members. I'm happy to provide more information for you to explore through this reference here listed on the slide. I have a couple of copies if you would like to take one home. A following phase, again, through a second set of interviews and participatory workshops where we used digital polling devices, we worked to identify the ways in which the community defines health for itself. What does a Squaxin Indigenous health look like? And what are the attributes of well-being? For example, one of the quotes from our interviews, here, health in the tribal community, it's spiritual health, mental health, physical health. Health here is being connected to our culture. We are canoe families, people of the water. We're very connected to the Puget Sound. A big part of our health has to do with being connected with that water. So I'm showing here on the slide the seven indicators that grouped from our interviews together, which were verified through our community workshops. And these are physical health, community connections, natural resources security, cultural practices and uses, education and traditional knowledge, self-determination, and resilience, or a balance of these attributes. And I'd love to tell you a little bit more about how each one of these is defined specifically for the Squaxin Island tribe with some examples of what it looks like. And I have some handouts that I have with me at my Sea Grant table over here on this side of the room. So then what we did was we asked, what is the status of these attributes of health as they are today? And what might be the impacts to these aspects of health given what we expect from future ocean changes? And listed here on the slide is a rank order. You'll see those seven indicators again. And on the left-hand side, the most vulnerable indicators to ocean change are in red. And along the gradient of high vulnerability to low vulnerability, you can see how they all map out. So each one of the indicators declined in health, and we see an overall vulnerability to ocean acidification in the community and to well-being. However, what we also learned was that some elements might be more sensitive and some elements are strong and more resilient to changes. Identifying where there might be these sensitivities was a tool to help generate discussions in our workshops where participants in our workshops discussed potential actions that might be a priority to take. And among those actions that came up over and over again was a focus on strengthening food sovereignty, in part because it really clusters around strengthening all aspects of health that you see here pictured. And what I'd like to do now is invite my colleague and friend Alita Post, the community Squaxin Island Community Guard Manager, to come and talk about the Food Sovereignty Project.
Twa gulapu, gulapu di ished. The Paul quote teaches that, Krishapi teaches that at teaches koi. Squach Sedebshed. I wanted to open up by acknowledging and speaking our traditional language. That is the Holshutsi language that is part of the larger Salishan language of the South Puget Sounds, the North Puget, and part of the east side of the mountains. I recognized all of you as my relatives because as we sit here today and we all speak about the impacts that are happening to our earth, we need to acknowledge each other as that we are all connected in this way, that we all hold a vital thread to this larger blanket that we call life. And in doing so and recognizing that, I'm also speaking to the land and to the territory that we are in today. This area is part of Squaxin's traditional territory, and we are in the Kamilche Valley right now, and Kamilche in our language means the peaceful valley. And so for all of you here today, I hope that you get a sense of that peace on your journey back home. I also introduced to you my traditional name. My traditional name is Tlapalquo. That means deep water. I also introduced to you my mother. My mother's name is Kuitlapi. Her name means mist on the water. So we are very intrinsically tied to the protection of the water, and we hold that stewardship in high regard. We come from the land of Squaw Sedebsh, the Squaxin people, Sehe Wamish people, and the literal translation for that means people of the water. And so to be here today and to hear some of your talks and some of, I'm looking forward to hearing some of the conversations that will be happening after our presentation about water quality and water preservation. I just want to hold my hands up and say thank you to all of you for being here and to doing the work that everybody is doing to protect our most vital resource that we have. As Melissa said, I am the program manager for the Squaxin Island Community Garden. The community garden was established in 2016 after we did a number of interviews throughout our community. We collected quite a bit of data and holding different community gatherings. And one of the common things that kept coming out during these gatherings was that our people needed a place to gather together around food again, that we needed a central location to uphold the knowledge that exists within our community and to uphold the strengths of each other with that knowledge that exists and to instill that sense of stewardship into our children again. And through those conversations, a community garden was brought up several times. And over the last decade or two, our people, our tribal people, have been requesting a community garden. And this is some of the food that we grow in our garden is not native to this area, but we have adopted a lot of things from the Western culture, so why not adopt something that's healthy? And we also take that opportunity to strengthen the knowledge and to build some of those bridges between different universities, different entities, and other agencies that are doing work around restoration, primarily around food. So through these conversations in partnership with Melissa, one of the things that kept coming up was bringing back the knowledge around harvesting seafood, harvesting kelp, sea cucumber, the seaweeds that grow up and down the coast, some of these sea vegetables that our people knew that we ate, but the knowledge is still out there, but it's not as strong as it once was. Also around that conversation was the talks about bringing back the camas, the food, the bulb that Charlene had talked about. It's actually a flower. It's a flower that grows in the prairie, and it is a camas bulb, and so it's a flower bulb that is high in starch, but when cooked right, it breaks down into a digestible fructose, and so it becomes like a natural sugar in your body, and this fructose is developed into inulin, which is really good for people with diabetes. So there's a lot of our traditional foods that we're bringing back into our community, along with strengthening the knowledge that exists within our community, and then reaching out to other partnerships to say, what can we do in order to help strengthen what restoration programs you are doing as well. So the photo above is a photo of one of our relatives, Red Wolf Christ, and he is working with a youngster there to build up some of the soil that we have at the community garden. The garden is located just down the road from the casino. If you are leaving the casino and you take a left, we're right after the casino parking lot and right before the tobacco factory. It was an old horse arena or old horse pasture. The tribe had purchased this land back and it had been sitting dormant for several years. And so when the tribe said, let's get a community garden started, we looked at this area. We knew that the ground in the Comanche Valley is very fertile. And so we decided that this is where we were going to start our garden at. So here are some before and after photos. The before photos, you can kind of see that there's some alder trees growing in there. There was blackberry bushes taking over the barn that was like 8 feet high, and then a lot of scotch broom. And so we called out to Squaxin and said, here's a day that we're going to come down and we're going to work together to restore this area because it had been sitting dormant for so long and we wanted to make this happen. And so below is a photo from the beginning of this year. And right now we have 7 beds in our garden. It's in the shape of a circle of a medicine wheel garden. And those 7 beds represent the 7 inlets of the Squaxin Island tribe. And then you can see in the center pathway, there's oyster shells. And those oyster shells were sifted from our Salish Seafoods Company and were added to help enhance the calcium that was in this area and to help suppress some of the weed growth. But also it was symbolic for us to be able to tie the sea and the land together in our garden. So over the last few years of starting the community garden, we have held several community discussions about the direction that we want to go with this and why it came about and making sure that we're tapping into those core reasons of why the community garden is here. And the first and foremost thing that comes about is food resiliency and climate adaptation, because we know that there's changes happening in our world, and these changes affect all of our harvesting sites, from our stinging nettle to our mountain huckleberries to our camas to our sea vegetables, our seaweed, and our kelp. We know that the changes in the environment are affecting each of these. And so what are we doing to make sure that our impact is minimal, but it's also sustaining the very core of our culture? And so through that, we hold a lot of conversations around the stewardship of the land and of the sea. And when we go out and harvest our traditional foods, we make sure that we go over harvesting ethics and what it means to leave enough for that the community that exists around that plant or the vegetable or the fruit that we're gathering. And through those gatherings, we are reestablishing intergenerational teachings and interactions. And so what that means is that we're able to bring together our elders who have had this experience, who have been out harvesting with their grandparents and who know these woods and who know these mountains. And then they in turn are getting the opportunity to pass down that knowledge again to different generations. Sometimes it's not always the generation of, it's not a direct family member, but it's part of that larger group of, we are all Squaxin and we are all here to protect what little there is. And so one great example of that is when we go out and we harvest camas. Camas is one of the, next to salmon, it was our next most traded resource. And it was something that that there was vast trade systems going up the coast, up towards Vancouver Island or Victoria Island, no, Vancouver Island. And then across the mountains over to Yakima. And it's a food that our people revered highly. But right now, camas prairies, there's about 3% of camas prairies that exist within the Washington state, that at one point you could travel down the I-5 corridor from, say, I think it's Salem, Oregon, all the way up to Seattle, and that was all prairie at one point. And of course, that makes a really attractive area to put in a road because it's nice and flat. But that does have impacts on what people are able to gain access to. and a lot of the other prairies were used as farms or as, farms or other buildings. And so through that process, the overall population of camas has diminished, and camas is one of the foods that needs human interactions to really thrive. So when you dig up a camas bulb, you're aerating the soil and you're pulling out the largest bulb that's there, and the smaller bulbs around it are then able to grow bigger and stronger. And then through that process, it's creating bigger, stronger, and more camas, and so it becomes more abundant. And so through these gatherings, we're able to share that knowledge again and what it really means to have that connection back to our food and where it grows and how to protect it is so vital to this next and up and coming generation. At our community garden, we established what's called a First Foods Trail. And so this is to really highlight the foods that exist right outside our door. A lot of these foods are abundant in the Washington's kind of like foresty wetlands, and they grow in abundance all throughout our area. And so we wanted to really uphold those and acknowledge it and create that opportunity for our people to taste and to see what foods are here again. So I have at my mark to finish, but I just want to leave in closing, just say again, thank you for all that you all are doing and for taking the time to be here today and to hear what we are doing here at Squaxin in terms of food sovereignty. And thank you.
Do we have questions for these presenters?
Thank you for sharing that. I'm curious, you mentioned harvesting kelp and other seaweeds. Was there any evidence that those were tended in the saltwater environment or just foraged without modification? And also curious, what sorts of food products were made from them?
So the kelp that we have harvested over the years, it's at the south point of the Squaxin Island. It's just outside the entrance of the Bud Bay area. That is an area that our people have tended for thousands of years. And all throughout the Southern Salish Sea, our people have maintained these areas. Some of the stories that are shared from our elders is that there were certain plots or areas that families maintained and took care of, and that would be like their kind of like their garden or like their family area. And it was known that there were certain harvesting techniques that were done in order to preserve or even enhance the growth of the kelp. And then as the second part of your question, do you mind repeating that?
I was just curious what sorts of food products were made from the kelp.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so I can't speak to too much of what was previously made, but today we still gather kelp and we like to pickle it, and it's absolutely amazing pickled. You can saute it with a little bit of vinegar and a little bit of butter and garlic, and you could also, you know, do like your traditional pickling and put it in a jar and, you know, cure it that way.
So I had a question about whether the Squaxin ever maintained clam gardens. I know in some other parts of Puget Sound, they move the rocks and change the intertidal slightly. And I've had the opportunity to see some in some other areas, but I've never heard it talked about here.
Squaxin Island, we're one of the wealthiest historical tribes. Mile per mile, beach per beach, we had the most productive shellfish beaches. And if you can imagine, right now, looking out on the water, if you owned land near the beaches, it is so beautiful. And of course, there's some beaches that are just naturally just full of they produce very well. And there's some areas, you know, where the tides impact the way those clams or the shellfish might grow. And it is my firm belief that our people did have their shellfish gardens. We had net pens, or not net pens, but fish rears that we would utilize so we would not over-harvest. We did our own natural resource type management. The same thing with shellfish gardens.